What's up, everybody? Welcome back to My Non-Expert Opinion. I'm your host, Chelsea Reif, and I'm a podcast strategist who helps people launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts. Now, if you're a first-time listener, you may not know that I'm a full-time digital nomad. So I'm always on the go, I'm always switching countries, and the constant requests I've gotten for honestly the past year has been, can you please share more about dating, your personal life, what is it like when you're on the go, how hard is it to meet people? And I was like, you know what? It's time to start talking about that. So today, you're in luck because I have an amazing guest, Jess Dante, on. She runs the account Love in London, which is an incredibly successful platform that shows mainly Americans and any expats how to adjust to the London lifestyle. So I really wanted to compare notes of, is it different when you're dating abroad all the time? Or would you say it's the same as America? What are the cultural differences? And what advice does she have if you are someone that doesn't really know anyone in the city, but you want to make friends or meet new people or find a cute little UK husband or boyfriend, you know? Like, what does that look like? What do you got to do to get there? So if you're into a girly chat about dating abroad or what it takes to actually move to the UK, specifically London, then this episode is for you. All right, loves, let's jump into this week's episode with Jess Dante. How is that English accent? It's so embarrassing. All right, let's get into this week's episode. Okay, Jess, Love and London, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. So exciting.
And you're celebrating a birthday.
Yes, yesterday was my 34th birthday.
So you are a Leo.
Oh my God, such a Leo. Honestly, like I couldn't be more Leo. I'm as Leo as you get, basically.
It makes a lot of sense because Love in London is very Leo energy, I feel like. It's just like everything on stage, front and center, spotlight. Why don't you tell us about Love in London? Because people listening are hearing your American accent, so you're not British.
No, I'm definitely not. Yeah.
So how long have you lived in London?
So July, which was last month, was my 10-year anniversary of moving to London.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's been a long time. So basically what Love in London is it's basically a social media company, and we create content specifically for people who are coming to visit London. So lots of YouTube videos about like how to take the tube, and we'll do Instagram reels about restaurants that we think are worth it or not worth it. You know, we're on TikTok, we have written content, an email newsletter. And yeah, so we're always creating lots of free content for people who are coming to visit so they can make their trip as great as possible and to maximize their time in London. We also sell digital travel guides. So we have itineraries that people can buy. That's our biggest seller. And then we also have our casual tourist guides, which are more for people who want to avoid the tourist attractions and only want to do like very local, cool stuff. So
oh my gosh, this is so random, but I got this book at a thrift store. It's like 50 cents and it's so cheesy. It's like a kind of like erotica novella thing written in early 2000s. And the girl in the book, like the protagonist, she started a company called like the Real England Tour Company. And the whole thing is to take people behind the scenes of like what real London is, not all the tourist stuff. And I'm like, this is very weird that that's basically what you just said. And it's a book that is from literally like 2001 that I'm reading right now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people have been trying to get off the, you know, quote unquote beaten path for a long time now. It's, I mean, huge. That's the, you know, everyone says they want to do that now. It's not necessarily the case, but yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Ooh, well, maybe I need to borrow that.
I know. I'm like, Jess, did you inspire that book? So I don't know that a lot of people know this, but when I started my whole like living abroad journey, England and London was the first place I wanted to come. So I started interviewing at companies in London, and I even flew to London and Manchester over my Thanksgiving break like 4 or 5 years ago to interview at specific companies. Funny enough, do you guys know Stephen Bartlett, the guy that runs Diary of CEO? He had a company called Social Chain. I interviewed there.
Oh.
And they basically at the end of it were just like, the visa thing is really annoying and we don't want to deal with that. And I kept trying and trying. And then even my friends who had married British guys were like, it's really hard, even as a person that is the wife of a British person, you don't just automatically get citizenship. And I was like, I did not know it was this hard to immigrate. And I'm really curious how, especially 10 years ago, your immigration journey went.
Yeah. I mean, I totally want to validate that for you. It's a really hard process. And, you know, even for people coming from the United States, which has a pretty good relationship with the UK. And no, I didn't know all that you had done all that.
I'm just very undercover.
Yeah. Well, I imagine if you were working in the US too.
Yeah.
At the time. So basically, when I moved here 10 years ago, I did so because I married somebody who was British. So we married for love, but we ultimately had to get married a lot earlier than we thought because we had to get me a visa to be able to come here because otherwise it's very difficult. So yeah, we got married over in New York and then I applied for a spouse visa and got it about a month and a half later. And then I basically have had to, that was for about 2.5 years. I had to apply for a second one. And then at the 5-year point is when I was able to get indefinite leave to remain, which is basically kind of like a green card / permanent residency. And then once I had that, I can have that for the rest of my life. And also it meant that my time staying here did not depend on being married to this person, whereas the spouse visas did. If we had divorced during the spouse visas, I would have had to leave. But because when we ultimately did get divorced after I got my indefinite leave to remain, thankfully, I was able to stay after all that rigmarole. So now it's been 10 years. I have been eligible for citizenship for about 4 years now. I just haven't pulled the plug / it's obviously like kind of expensive to do it. And it's a lot of paperwork. And I just haven't. I've always like thought that I definitely wanted to stay here, but I kind of wanted to solidify that I for sure did, which I do. So it's actually on my list of things to do this month is to get the ball rolling on that. So I will eventually be a British citizen as well.
Oh my gosh. I feel like the visa process in every country is so mystical and some are so easy. Like my Australian visa, I applied and I'm not kidding. 5 seconds later, I got an approval letter because it's a working holiday visa and they need so much help with all the tourism stuff there. And they need people working all these weird jobs just to, and it's so far away that they're like, we'll take anybody. So literally hit apply, got it right away. But then again, my experience with trying to get into Britain was a nightmare and I just gave up. I'm curious, even when you just said it's so expensive and so much paperwork, how expensive is it and how much paperwork do you think would it take to get it?
Yeah, well, so for my journey, I made a reel about it a few months ago and I think I had like tallied up that basically I'd spent about 10 grand on visas so far, which some people in the comments were like, 10 grand for 10 years, that's actually not that bad. And I was like, yeah, but like, it's not quite like that, is it? So yeah, and then I think the citizenship stuff, I think I've had a couple of friends do it recently, and I think it was like 25 grand, not 25 grand. Well, no, oh, sorry, 2,500, 25 grand, imagine, which actually is not that bad considering you are getting citizenship to a brand new country, but it's, you know, still a lot of money. So it's, yeah, it's expensive. And if you need to get lawyers, some people do, that adds to it as well. And I didn't know that Americans could get working holiday visas in Australia, though.
Oh my gosh, it's the easiest one. Oh. We actually even get a better deal than a lot of other countries where if you want to stay a second year, a lot of other people have to work 88 days on a farm,
right,
in like a very rural area. You will literally be like packing bananas in a remote farm, and Americans can work in hospitality or tourism. So you could still work in a rural area, but it could be like a hotel receptionist or like the front desk manager. And yeah, so Americans, it's really easy to get over there, but not a lot of Americans go.
I mean, it is really far, like yeah. You said. Really, you can't really get any farther than going to Australia. So
exactly.
I've heard good things.
Why do you think it's so hard to get into Britain?
Listen, I think, you know, the U.S. is actually, I think, worse than when you're trying to get a visa over there than here. This is way above my pay grade, but we have had, obviously, we were in the EU for a long time, which was actually, from what I've read and in my opinion, was really good for having enough labor here. We've now left, obviously, so we're lacking in labor in a lot of different industries. But I think it's also, it's just a lot of people want to come here. So they are quite strict on who they let in, which is like fair/unfair. I mean, we could go on for hours, I'm sure. And again, like privileged white American going through this process is much different than people from various different other countries. It's a whole different experience. So yeah, they really make you work for it. I think the only thing that I struggle with is the fact that a lot of people, the path to being able to come here is marriage. And that opens itself up to people being in like abusive relationships. Because if you're over here and you have to stay with this person for 5 years and you have to leave the country, if you divorce them, that means you are kind of stuck. So if you don't really have any other options. So that's my only gripe about how difficult. Not my only gripe, but I do have a problem with how difficult that can be because it does leave a lot of people with not a lot of options if things go wrong. That was not my situation at all, but it's not a great setup really.
Yeah. I feel like even with the spousal visa, it's hard because my best friend married a British guy and we thought it was literally instant. Like, great, here's a marriage license, send it over. And she's like, absolutely not. I've had to hire lawyers. It's taken months. She actually took a plane ride to the UK, thought she was all cleared and got detained. And she had to fly back to the United States and she's married. At this point, she had the British husband and everything. And I think Americans were, because we don't travel or at least not travel, we don't try to get citizenship a lot in other countries. We think it really is easy. Like, oh, you just sign a paper and you have it. And that whole process opened my eyes to like, wow, even if you marry someone there, it's still going to be hard. It sounds like your experience, maybe it was difficult, but it sounds like hers was just insane. Like, what is the process too? Because I know there's people that are dating foreigners right now that are like, oh, okay, maybe you could do the spousal visa, but is it just as easy as signing something and you have the visa?
No, it's not. So similar to what your friend said when I did it, you know, we got married in New York and then I had to stay in New York for a month and a half while I got all the paperwork together. And you basically have to prove that you're in a legitimate relationship. So we had to put in like screenshots of our Skype, daily Skype calls and of our WhatsApp chats. We had to include the original cards from our wedding of like our friends saying, congratulations on your marriage and this and that. And our plane tickets and just literally so much stuff that shows that we were in a legitimate relationship and we were marrying for love, not for a visa, although we were marrying for a visa because I was also the reason we all, I don't think I mentioned this, but the reason we got married 6 months after we met each other because I did try to come over to the UK while I was in the process of trying to get my Italian citizenship. So I could move here, obviously pre-Brexit. And basically, long story short, at Heathrow, they detained me for 9 hours, questioned me, and then they were like, you can't come into the country. And I was banned from coming back to the UK. So yeah, this is like the extremely short version of this story.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had to go back to New York. They put me on a flight, like 3 security guards escorting me through Heathrow, gave my passport to the pilot, put me on a flight back to New York. And really, the only option was for us to get married, to be able to actually, for me to get over here without waiting for my Italian passport, which would have taken like a year and a half. So yeah, that was why we got married so quickly. And I forgot what your original question was.
Oh, just about the spousal visa. It's not just signing a paper.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, so we had to put together the application and then send it off. And then we did the expedited one, so it only took a few days. But then once I had the visa, I booked a flight that day, or I booked a flight 3 days later to be able to come over. And but even still, after that, for about 2 years, every time, because it was before we could go through the e-gates, every time I went through immigration, when I got back to London or to the UK, they would detain me and ask me a bunch of questions because I had like this big red X on my account.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I'm like, I have the visa. Come on, you guys have given it to me. I don't know why you guys have to keep asking the same questions over and over. And sometimes they'd be so rude about it. And again, like it's in the grand scheme of things, it's not that big a deal. But everyone thinks like, oh, you just get married and you just go. And yeah, it's not the case.
No, it's not. Do you now still have a big X on your account?
No.
Okay.
So thankfully, after 2 years, I like went up at one point and I was like, oh, I just go through. Nobody asked anything. And then now I have the e-gates make it like so easy. I don't have to speak to anyone. I just go through and it's totally fine. And especially that I have my indefinite leave to remain permanent visa, which I can keep for the rest of my life until I get citizenship. So no, it's totally fine now. Much easier.
Okay. Amen. I have a question too, because I think a lot of people get married or move for love and they're like, yeah, we want to make this work. We don't want to be overseas long distance. Like, that's really hard. I also was in a situationship. I was in a situation like that. Sorry. I was in a relationship.
Yeah.
I was not in a situationship with a German. And due to all these rules and the 90 days in the Schengen zone and da da da, we had to have 3 full months apart while we were together, which is very weird when you're in a new relationship. It was our first year spending 90 days apart. And this was during COVID. And then when I finally got there, I was like just so happy to finally be together. But then when the dust settled a little bit, I was like, I actually don't like where we live. We were living in like a small fishing town in northern Germany. I didn't know the language. I didn't have friends. I mean, it was really hard. And that was primarily one of the reasons we broke up, was like, I just can't live here. Did you know when you moved that you wanted to live in London, or were you, have you visited before? Or is it just like, let's see what happens?
Yeah, I had visited for 4 days before that when I was studying abroad. So, I mean, I liked it then. I think it was quite interesting because when I first moved over for the first year and a half, my ex, now ex and I lived out in Surrey. So we were in the suburbs. And for the first like year, I was happy to just be there and just happy to be in the country and, you know, making friends with all of my ex's friends and getting to know my in-laws and stuff. And then I got to like a year in and I was just like, ooh, no, I'm such a city person. So I couldn't drive. So I was heavily reliant on my ex to drive me places or friends to drive places. Yeah.
I did not.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
They're like your babysitter sometimes. Yeah, yeah. And you're like, I want to do this myself. I just can't. I don't have like the license or the rule. Nothing works for me because I'm not a citizen. So yeah, I get it.
Exactly. It's you that you feel like you're like 15 again.
Literally. Yeah.
So I basically like was then on a crusade to convince my ex to like move into London, which was kind of hard because his work was like quite far outside of London. So that was a sacrifice for him to do like quite long commutes. But it was like a really pretty town in Surrey, but I needed to be in London and in the city because then once we moved into London, then I've got buses. I can get around all my own. I also branched out and was able to make a lot more friends that had more of like a similar vibe to me. And so I think also that is a huge risk that I think people don't really think about is love. Unfortunately, this is going to get really deep, but love does not conquer all. Ultimately, if you're in a place that you are not happy and that does not work with the lifestyle that you personally want, it's going to be really difficult. It's also extra difficult if you're living, and I'm sure you can attest to this, but if you're living in a place that your partner has lived for a really long time, so they're used to it. They've got all their connections. Also, if your partner has never done what you've done, obviously this is a generalization. Not everyone is like this. However, it's really hard for them to really understand what you're going through. And also the fact that I was fine for like the first 3 years. And then I've noticed it was for me and a lot of my other friends who've moved abroad. The 4 year mark is when it starts to get actually quite difficult because you lose contact with a lot of your friends back at home. Everyone kind of like moves on with their lives. People stop visiting as much or, you know, people are getting married, having kids, so they can't anyway. And you kind of like start to lose your connections back at home. And it can be really hard. And if you are with somebody who has never done that, it can be, again, generalization, but I found it can be very difficult for them to support you and to really understand. So it's a big thing. I think it's very like, it's romanticized. I'm sure I romanticized it quite a lot until, you know, things hit the fan, but it's hard. It's really, really hard. And yeah, love is not like the only factor of what's going to make something work.
Yeah. And I think that dynamic of plugging yourself into someone else's life, which is their home turf, that whole experience taught me about sacrifice versus compromise. And it's something I talked about in therapy a lot after we broke up because I was like, did I sacrifice my life or did I compromise for him? And I want to share this for anyone who maybe is in this situation is my therapist explained it in a way that resonated with me is like sacrifice feels like a depleting energy. Like you're like toiling every day. You have to cheerlead yourself all the time. Like give yourself a pep talk every morning. Like, okay, day 75 in this place. Let's go, Chelsea. Like that's the type of energy of sacrifice where compromise is a little more uplifting and you know it's very temporary. It's almost that optimistic thing of like, I know right now it's not the best thing in the world, but I'm going to make it work and I'm happy to be here. It's fine. But there's an end date. You don't have to pep talk yourself all the time. And I think when looking back at the situation, unfortunately, I do feel like I sacrificed and I don't think I compromised. He was in school and he was going to be in Germany for 4 years. And in my mind, I'm like, 4 years, like you said, 3 years, 4 years, that'll fly by. And 1 year did fly by, but it was the day to day that I was like, I don't speak the language. We were in a town that no one spoke English. It was COVID. Everything was locked down. We lived with roommates. We had a dog. I had just started my business. Like, I'm like, this is not the hub for making connections in my business. It was so, so hard. And I know for you, love in London, eventually now what it is, it became a huge piece of your life. So I'm curious, when did that start? And was that part of your like branching when you were in that relationship? Was love in London building while the relationship was also still happening?
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
So I started Love in London as a side project almost 8 years ago now. And I always knew I wanted to run my own business. Like ever since I was a kid. That was just what I wanted to do. And I was working in corporate at the time in social media, and I was like, this is not the vibe. So I got to do something. And then even when I went freelance in social, I was like, I don't want to do that either. I definitely want to have like my own thing where I'm not answering to clients and things like that. And so I was like, okay, I don't have any money, but I can start doing content and see how that goes. And I started creating YouTube videos because there wasn't really anyone doing that much stuff about London at that time. Basically with the idea of, oh, I'll maybe become like an influencer or build up something along those lines. And I did that. I built it for about 2.5 years before I was able to switch to doing it full time. And then, yeah, just kind of went from there. When I could devote full-time work to it, it just kept growing and growing. And I was learning how to do email marketing and how to create like a digital product and how to make my videos better. And I could slowly start to hire freelancers to help me. And so, yeah, I built the majority of that was built up. A big majority of it was built up when I was still with my ex. And then, I mean, thankfully I had it when we were going through our separation. And that was part of what kind of kept me going during that year. And also obviously financially, like it was doing really well the year that I like really needed that money because we were going through the divorce. So I was really thankful for that. And then, yeah, besides COVID, which was just basically a wipeout, it's been great. Like the last year and a half has been, I mean, travel has picked up like crazy. So we kind of can't keep up with demand. It's great.
That's insane. I'm curious, as an American running a company that highlights so much British culture, do you ever get pushback from people in comments or even companies that you want to highlight that it's like, you're not actually British?
Yeah, I do. So not brands or anything. I think they totally get it and understand. And to be honest, I think 95% of people get it because especially the majority of our audience are Americans. And I think actually they quite like that. And they like the story of how I moved over here. And I know how to explain things in a simplistic way for people who have maybe never taken public transport and things like that. So, but we do, I mean, TikTok is like the cesspit of comments. It's just, honestly, I just have to like not even go on it anymore because it's so bad. But anytime we have a video that goes viral, it's always loads of people who are like, she's not even English, like blah, blah, blah. It's always young kids. And I can tell they've never been to London because anyone who's been to London and explored a little bit knows that London is an extremely diverse city. And it's not only English / British people. We have people from all over the world. So you can tell like they've never actually been to London before. But yeah, we do get it. But it's the majority of people totally understand.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about like negativity online, because the other day I experienced my first comment and it truly wasn't even that negative. But to me, it felt like, here we go. Like, this is the start of it. I basically had this picture of me, and people know what I'm talking about. It's like my shirt's unbuttoned. I'm wearing these little shorts and my legs are all oiled up. It's a very like sexy photo. And I used it as a background to promote a launch that I have coming up. The whole point of that photo shoot, by the way, was for my new website. So it has to do with my business. And that was the whole point of the rebrand, was like, I'm not going to be the good girl that's just like showing you pictures on my laptop and with a microphone. I was like, I want it to feel more edgy. And so it is a bit edgy. And someone commented, and they were like, weird background though, ? And it was like someone that doesn't have any followers, doesn't follow anyone, no pictures or anything. And then someone DM'd me and they're like, that might have actually been someone you know that maybe was using like a burner account or something. And I'm like, well, that doesn't A, make me feel any better. But B, it sent me into this spiral of like, do I respond in a kind way and almost make them feel stupid, like kill them with kindness? Do I be snarky and something like, thanks so much for this constructive feedback? Do I block them? Do I delete their comment? Do I DM them and say, hey, why did you write this? Like, there were so many things going on in my head. Eventually, I decided to just block them because I'm like, they're not my target audience. They're not my listener, etc. That was one comment. It sounds like on TikTok, you're getting a lot whenever something goes viral. How did you, what was your first experience reading a negative comment and how did you deal with it?
God, the first experience. I mean, that would have been a long time ago. I can't really remember, to be honest, like what the first experience was, but actually I was probably fine. There's only certain things that really bother me. And it's often because I'm like, that's be true. You know, I also I've always had a thing where I hate when, how do I explain it? I basically just hate when people try to make out that I'm stupid. So for example, like we churn out so much content that obviously I make mistakes. But if I make a mistake on a video that goes onto TikTok and Instagram, people will be like, even if one person or five people already pointed it out, 5,000 more will continue to point it out and just keeps popping up, popping up, popping up, popping up. And I'm just like, oh my God, guys, obviously we get it. Like everyone has seen it. People make mistakes. It's just, I mean, that's not even like that negative, but I think I'm probably not the best person to ask like what you're supposed to do, because you are technically people, they say to just like delete and ignore. I'm a big comment deleter. I'm like, you're in my house. If I don't fight, even if it's like, a lot of people think they're being constructively critical and they're not. So I'll delete. And then some people are like, I can't believe you're deleting comments. And I'm like, because you're very rude about it. That was not constructive at all. I'll leave constructive stuff. That's fine. And I do, yeah, I do a lot of deleting and a ton of blocking. And then sometimes I'm in a bad mood and I reply. So part of the thing is, it's kind of like a fine line, because part of our brand is that we are a little bit more snarky than the typical like Instagrammer who's like, come to this beautiful place. That's right. Like actually not that good. And what differentiates us too is I'll say, I think you should skip the British Museum because it's the biggest collection of stolen artifacts in the world. And that makes people super angry. And people get very like, a woman with an opinion is a huge problem. They're like, you're uneducated, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, what do you mean? There's loads of articles out there. It's like very well known.
Right.
They even talk about it on their website. It's, yeah. So that's always like a bit of a thing for me. And sometimes there's a really good opportunity for a snarky reply and people like find it, other people find it really funny. So it just depends. And sometimes I'm like, I should not be on this account right now because I'm in a bad mood. I'm tired. I'm cranky. I'm hungover. And or I've just had enough of this for this week. And then some people will reply saying like, oh, you're being like defensive. And I'm like, well, you're blocked as well. So yeah. Goodbye.
That's the thing that I've learned. Like, there's no right way to answer. If you're too nice, people are like, oh, you should have gone after them or deleted them, or babe, you don't have to defend yourself. You could just block them. And then if you block them, they're like, wow, no accountability. You're never going to win. So I think it is kind of a case-by-case basis. And I shared about this in my stories, which I think might be helpful for people, is I think I would have answered to demonstrate leadership and like direct communication if it was someone that actually listened to the podcast, followed me, invested in my work, was a client, like anyone that I can constantly see in my DMs and liking me. If they wrote that, I would be like, hey, let's have a conversation because I am curious because you're in my world. This person was just a random ass person. And I was like, to your point, you're in my house. I always like to think of it as a birthday dinner. Your birthday dinners are like intimate. You know who you want there. It would be very weird if some like out of left field character just showed up and was like yelling brash things at you. You'd be like, why are you at my birthday dinner?
Yeah.
So I'm like, you're not at my birthday dinner anymore, blocked. So I think that's a great tip, is just like, also, yeah, your state of mind. Make sure you're not in like the worst mood ever and hungover and PMSing. And,
oh my God, yeah. And don't follow my
yeah. on that. I mean, I was ready to go in. I was like, I had my like fingers fired up and ready to go. And I was like, take a deep breath.
I
like,
know.
Don't let this get your energy. I'm curious too about going viral. There's so many people that create content that want to go viral. And I think the idea is if I go viral, more people will see me. I'll be more admired. I'll make way more money. And with all this money and fame and all these accolades, then I can rest or do what I want or go on the vacation. In my experience, like the more busy you get and the more viral you go, the more busy you get and the more viral you keep going. How has your experience been with videos going viral and like handling the influx of traffic and people following you?
Yeah. So something that I think people don't talk about very much is that you can go viral, but to the wrong audience. And that's kind of pointless. So we, unfortunately, like a lot of the stuff that we get that goes viral can be going to kind of like, I was saying before, 13-year-olds up in Blackpool who are never going to come to London. And so we have to like be really careful about how we deal with that. And also we're always kind of trying to analyze what kind of virality do we want that we can try to reach the right people? But unfortunately, like, you don't really have control over that a lot of the time. It's kind of a lot, I think, and I would say actually going viral is not that important. It can like give you a bump in followers, which can be good. But again, if it's like the wrong type of followers or if it's just reaching the wrong people, they're not going to follow anyway because they're not that interested in what you're actually saying day to day. I think like consistency and, you know, a normal level of views is actually much better, and where you're having videos of people actually commenting with like, oh, that's really helpful. Thank you. Or asking other questions and this and that. So yeah, it's hard though, because I know, like, you know, for us, it is good. Like, sometimes we do want to see those numbers. Obviously, when it comes to working with brands, it does help to be able to say, like, we're reaching 2 million people a month on Instagram and 2 million on TikTok. And that is usually because we've had like at least one video that month go viral. But it's kind of like there's pros and cons to it.
Yeah. I think a lot of people might also not understand how an account like this makes money. And so I would love to hear more about that whole piece of it, because there's probably people listening right now like, oh, I live in this place and I want to spotlight all the amazing things going on. I'm assuming it's brand partnerships and content deals, but can you share a little bit more about how Love in London creates financial stability or revenue?
Yes. Yeah. In the last year, our main revenue is from sales of our guides in our Shopify shop. So that's like the bread and butter for us. That's the be all end all. I have never wanted to rely on brand partnerships to be able to pay my team, to pay myself. It's just so unstable. And also, in travel, the rates are disgustingly low of what brands usually are willing to pay versus lifestyle, like beauty, fashion, although I've heard that's changing a bit as well. But, you know, with talks of the potential recession happening, again, like that's just an excuse for brands to just be like, we're going to offer you. I had an email the other day or yesterday from a brand that said, we want you to do 2 Instagram reels. We have 250,000 followers on our Instagram. 2 reels. Only talking about our brand for £700 altogether. And I was like, are you joking? Anyway, so our Shopify shop is always going to be something. I have one person who's dedicated only to that, who she has been working for me for a few years now, but she is only, her one job is to like make sure that's continuing to grow. She's working on conversion, trying to, you know, how can we bring more traffic? How can we set up an affiliate program? Because then our second biggest revenue is brand partnerships. But because we aren't relying on brand partnerships, we can pass on lowball deals and only work with like 2 to 3 partners a year that are going to pay good money. And excitingly, this morning, actually, before we started recording, I signed on with a talent management company. So they're
oh my God, yeah, congrats.
Thank you. Yeah, they're great. They're going to be, so they'll be handling all of our brand stuff moving forward. And they take a commission off of that. But that's going to free up a lot of my time. And also they know they're better at like pricing and negotiations and stuff. So that will be great.
Oh my God, that is so exciting.
I know. I'm really so happy.
And to give everyone context, when she was like, £700, are you joking? Brands have literally hundreds of millions of dollars, right, to spend on advertising. I mean, look at Barbie, right? They spend, I think, $150 million on advertising. Think of £700 as not even like 1% of that budget. And I remember I used to work in influencer and content marketing for years, and we would $700 would be like a mom blogger living in the random ass Utah that does recipe posts like twice a month. Mm. You're talking about, like you said, 250,000 followers, reels, which is video content that's editing, that's captions, that's sounds, all that stuff adds money. And then for people that don't know this too, exclusivity, right? We only want you talking about us. Well, now you're completely denying me opportunities to work with other brands. So that is another cost. So if you're an influencer or content creator or want to be, factor all this stuff into your cost, right? It's not just, oh, one video. There's, oh, you want me to go to a different place and shoot all these pieces of content and do all these things and be exclusive? Like, that's thousands and thousands of dollars. To give you guys insight too, back in the day when we would work with mom bloggers all the way to like celebrity style influencers, and the ones that were represented by talent agencies, minimum, their Instagram posts for one photo would be like $25,000. Mm. So that's just for everyone to get it. When you're like, are you kidding? It's like, yeah, that should have probably been like a $25,000 deal, not £700.
Oh, yeah.
I'm curious too, even when you say good money, because I think people really don't understand. Are we talking like 4 to 5 figures? Is this 6-figure deals? Like, where are we at with the ranges of this?
Yeah. So the biggest one I've done was, I'm trying to think in dollars, it was around like, I think it would be like $33,000. So I did that last year. And then, but that's abnormally high for, I can't say who it is, obviously, because I don't think I've got like an NDA or anything with that. But obviously, like, brands are just really funny about talking about it, which I hate. But that was like a really big one. But now I have I sent out an email this morning and saying like, we have a $7,000 minimum in pounds, because we just don't have capacity to do these like tiny ones anymore. And also we're doing really good numbers on everything. And by the time like contracts get sent through, and then, and again, this is what the team's going to be handling now from now on. But it's like, and I, like you said, I have to pay my team to edit these videos. Like my team is involved in anything that's going to, basically anything that's going to be paid. So really, realistically, I'm not really doing anything under 10 grand anymore. And that's for multiple different pieces, not just like one post, but just like the admin time that it takes and everything. So this year, my goal is, let me just do the math quickly. I think I have in my revenue goals for brand partnerships to do about 75,000 pounds. Might be a bit more than that, actually, 80,000 maybe. But our goals for the Shopify shop are higher than that because we always, again, like want to be balancing that out.
I'm so glad you talked about that too, that actually you made the Shopify the main core of where your revenue comes from, because this is something I've talked about with clients that I work with a lot of people that are coaches or consultants, and they're like, I think I just want to do brand partnerships and be an influencer. And I'm like, that is a very, very unstable road, and you're going to get sick of it because a lot of us left jobs so we don't have to work for other people. When you take on a brand partnership, you're basically their employee for the time contracted. You have to follow their rules, say what they want you to say. They want a revision. You have to do it. You're under contract. And you're like, that's not even what I would post. But you signed the deal. And so now imagine you have five of these deals and you're like, wait, now I'm doing something for this person and this person's a different brand voice. It becomes very overwhelming. So I always caution my clients against going full influencer. And again, it's a bit unstable. Like a lot of us monetize our lifestyles, but what if your lifestyle changes? Look at lockdown, what happened? My life used to be inspirational in Australia. And then all of a sudden I was like living in this tiny fishing village. I'm like, this isn't exactly brand amazing, like content material that they would want to work with. So I think if you are someone right now who's listening, that's like, I want to go full-time content creator, think of how you could do something like Jess has done and actually make your platform the main thing where you're creating digital products. Maybe in the future, you guys would have like travel consultants or a whole branch that's like travel agents of helping people book their trips to London, where you have revenue streams that are just focused on you guys and not outside partners.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And also, you can make way more money earlier by selling your own stuff than if you're having to wait for brands to see you've reached 15,000 followers, 20, which is no brand's even really going to pay very much for 15,000 followers. Whereas you could build up with a really small audience, especially if you're quite niche, you could build up your email list to 5,000 people and easily sell a really good amount of money of like specialized digital products, or even if it's not digital stuff, your own thing without having to wait till you have these big. And then also the amazing thing about that is that you're not like glued to the numbers all the time. Because I was listening to a podcast with Ali Abdaal this morning, and he was saying they do lots of brand partnerships, but the majority of his revenue on his YouTube channel comes from YouTuber course that they have. They make like millions a year on that. And he was like, it is so freeing that we have that because we're not like, this video, we need all these videos to perform super, super, super well. Obviously, they're trying to do well for their brand partners, but they're not basically like tied. Their livelihoods are not tied to how many views each of these videos gets. And I also feel like to a point that way as well, because it's not always about the views. We're also getting email subscribers from videos that aren't getting as good of views. And we're always trying to get better and stuff, but we're not at the mercy of those numbers.
Oh, this is like music to my ears too, because you're also talking about prioritizing email, which is a platform that you can directly speak to your ideal client instead of like, hopefully the 13-year-old from up north isn't going to comment on this. It's like, you know exactly that the people opting in are your ideal people. This is something that I think people don't even recognize about my podcast, especially new people. They're like, oh, how do you make money on the podcast? And I'm like, I don't make money off the podcast. I make my money through consulting, coaching, courses, trainings, and videos. And then the podcast, once in a while, I'll do a brand partnership if I really think it's aligned. But I went down the brand partner route last year and I was like, this is exhausting. I'm making pennies compared to what I could make from a coaching deal. And it's just too much. I want to focus on building my thing, not helping a multi-million dollar company become even richer.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put that, actually. Yeah. Focus. Yeah. Build your own thing, not someone else's.
Yeah, 100%. So we need to talk about dating in London.
Yeah.
I have always had a thing for British boys. Like when I was in Australia, everyone I dated or hooked up with was British. I remember in Vegas, maybe 5 years ago at this point, an ex and I had broken up and I was like super depressed on this bachelorette party. And then all of a sudden we went to a club and the table of guys from Manchester with all these suits was sitting right behind us. And I was like, boom, I am over my ex. I am in love with this guy from Manchester. I love British guys. But as I've traveled more and more, my taste has expanded a little bit. And now I'm like, oh, it's so interesting being back here that my perception has changed a little bit of like dating a British guy. You were obviously married to one. Can you just talk about maybe some of the most or the biggest differences of dating a British guy versus maybe an American?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, so obviously London is people from all over the world, but I do actually, thinking back for the last couple of years as I've been single, I have mostly been on dates with men who are British. Yeah. So it's funny because I don't know if you saw this, but recently somebody interviewed me about the differences between dating in New York and dating in London for an article. And then the article came out like 2 days later and it was basically saying like, British men are cheap. Like, because I talked about how it feels like in the US that the guys are a little bit more chivalrous. I don't know if that's the right word for it, but they tend to, or in my experience, they tend to pick up the bill most of the time. Whereas here, it's been kind of interesting. I mean, it's just, let's just say it, a lot of guys here do not pick up the bill, which is, for me, you listen, you do you. Some people totally fine with that. So lots of women don't care. But for me, that's like, I really value generosity. And I'm also, if I'm completely honest, mostly going on dates with guys who make a lot more money than I do. So I'm like, you can't pick up dinner? Like, I've, you know, dressed to the nines, I'm in heels. And what are you like, what? Come on. And then I don't want to like crap on people who don't, they see it differently because listen, we all have like our things and stuff. But I think that's a big one for me. Also, in the US, people are just way more, and guys, especially in New York, are much more, they'll go up to people. And also in like friendship settings, like I'll go to New York City and I can just go anywhere by myself. And I know I'm going to like talk to loads of people. Whereas here, you probably experienced it. People are more closed off. And that also can happen with if you see someone at a bar you think is cute. So Kelly, our mutual friend, her and I were at one of the Soho houses a few months ago. And we were sat at the bar and there was a group of three guys that were sat to our left. And I went up and went to the toilet and then I came back. And they had been like looking over and Kelly was like, they just both, all of them watched you walk off to the toilet, watched you walk back, and they will, and she was like, they'll not say a word. They will not say a word. And I was like, yeah, that's exactly there. So people are way, they're not as like forthcoming, I would say, and not doing like approaching as much as in the US, which is kind of hard because then we have to default to the dating apps a little bit more, but nobody actually likes the dating apps. And so, yeah, I think it's just like a lot of my single friends, we all have the same complaint, guys as well, that no one's like approaching each other. We're all struggling to meet people, you know, quote unquote, in the wild. And it's quite interesting. Yeah.
That's so funny you said the thing about being tight-lipped. I think that's like a British thing is like you don't share your emotions that much. Mm-hmm. You're not that forward. And last week we went to this bingo thing. It was crazy. It literally looked like Ibiza. It was like people everywhere drinking, dancing on tables, and it was just bingo. And next to us, it was at, I don't know, I'm blanking on the venue name, okay. But these two guys were next to us and you could tell they wanted to like talk to me and all my friends. There was a group of four or five of us. And they just kept kind of looking over and looking over. And again, this is a very high energy, like, woo, like type of environment. And eventually something happened where we started talking and the guy was actually Irish, but he's lived in London for a very long time. And his friend was British. And they were just like, he was like, oh my God, you guys are American. And he's like, oh, I feel so more comfortable like talking to you now because I know you guys will actually like engage with me and interact with me. And he said, I find it really hard to just go up and talk to a British person or especially when you're out and about because that's just not the nature. Mm. And I found that fascinating because Americans, when we watch movies, that's not how it looks. The British people are always the James Bond guys, the Hugh Grants, the all these, you know, British people that are pedestalized in American media. And when you come here, at least my experience too, is like they're not going out of their way to be like, I have to know your name and let's go grab a drink. It's not really like that.
No, it's not at all. You're right, though, that I think Americans do have an advantage of that especially here, but also around the world, that we're known for being chatty. So actually that does help in our favor. And people do feel more comfortable a lot of times talking to us, which is good.
Yeah. We're definitely like, we get the reputation of being loud and annoying and da-da-da, but we also get a reputation of being very enthusiastic and chatty, which, to your point, I think people appreciate. What about the dating apps? I know we're talking about that and people don't really like them, but are there dating apps here that maybe we don't use in America?
No, I think so. The main, in my experience, the main one is Hinge. That's basically the only one I use.
That's what I'm on.
Yeah. I'm trying to get on Raya, but all my non-famous friends have gotten on it.
Literally, I was like, my friends that are random people have Raya.
I know. I don't know why. I'm like, guys, you see, I have 250,000 followers, right?
Maybe you're
like,
too big now.
Well, you know, thank you for saying
that. They need
that.
A new one. They need a higher tier now.
Yeah. That's so kind of you say. Bumble's quite big here as well. Tinder-ish. Not really. My friends don't use Tinder. But no, I would say there's anything here that is not in the U.S. that actually is used like quite a lot. Like there's this one I tried for a little bit called The League, which was kind of trying to be an in-between of Raya and Hinge and like a little bit more quote unquote exclusive. Is probably a little bit toxic, but I didn't find it to be helpful at all. People are on the apps to varying degrees of success. And yeah, again, like we're all trying to meet people in the wild, but I think for me too, it's kind of tricky because I don't work in an office. So a lot of the people, I mean, I meet people all the time, but I don't often meet guys who I am attracted to and also who are single or straight. I meet a lot of guys I find that are very attractive who are not interested in me because they don't like women. So
amazing. Yeah. Always happens like that.
Yep.
I found on the apps too, this is just in general, this isn't like a British thing or American thing, but it's like we're all just swiping and swiping and getting the dopamine hit of we match. But then when it goes to actually make a plan or reach out, nothing really happens. And then you're just like the dopamine hit completely dissipates. And you're just like, okay, do I reach out? But I don't really want to reach out. Like I'm at a stage in my life where I do want the guy to make the move. And okay, but like maybe I should reach out to plant the seed. And it's this whole thing where I'm like, I really would just rather meet someone out and about. But I haven't been drinking a lot, and it's hard to meet people when you're not going to pubs and bars and clubs. Mm-hmm. And so I've been going to a lot of like creative events and panels and things like that, because I think I would like to date someone like that. Do you have any advice for anyone visiting London of like, where would be a place to go if you're trying to meet someone in the wild?
Yeah, well, I think that what you're doing is exactly correct, especially if you're not that keen on drinking. Anything that aligns with what you're interested in and also what you're trying to find in a partner. So, I mean, obviously, I'm a big believer in what you're trying to look for in a partner. You need to also be that person too, so that it's a good match, because you can't like expect to meet someone with six pack abs if you don't ever go to the gym, right? Because they're not really going to be that interested, slash values will be different. But yeah, anything that's like aligns with your personal interests, I think is really good. There's lots of stuff. I mean, I don't know where you're finding the things you're going to, but like Eventbrite and meetup.com are both really good for finding both free and paid events. And just kind of like, I just think also saying yes to basically anything that anyone invites you to, there's going to be people around, like house parties, even if you don't drink, go to that, go for a couple hours. If someone's like, oh, do you want to, I'm going to this event or I'm doing that or blah, blah, blah. I'm very often like, yeah, I'll go. So House puts on like lots of different events that I'll go to. A lot of them are free, some of them are not. And it's like some of them are quite niche. And then I've found that to be full and like for making friends, but also meeting guys occasionally. So yeah, I think just kind of putting yourself out there. I mean, the apps can work. I use them when I travel, and actually they're really good for meeting people and just having like a fun evening out, hopefully paid for by somebody else. And also somebody that will be like, oh yeah, you don't know the city, so I'll take you, we'll go to this restaurant, go to this bar after. I find that really fun. So yeah.
I love that. There's also guys on the apps that will be like, I'm not a tour guide, because girls will be like, I want a tour of whatever, Valencia. And they're like, I'm not a tour guide. I'm
like, really?
That's hilarious. And yeah, I agree with mutual friends to me is like the ultimate way. I also find, I don't know if this is your experience, but British people tend to have these cliques from when they were in childhood schools together. So they kind of stay together from when they're like kids all the way, even like moving together to London, and they live by each other. And so sometimes it's hard to infiltrate these groups unless you have a bunch of mutual friends. But just like coming as an American by yourself and being like, I'm just going to pop into this new friend group, I have found that to be hard. But to your point, like our mutual friend Kelly invited me to her birthday a few years ago. And I met someone there and we had a fun little night. And I was like, oh, it was a mutual friend. Like that worked out really well. So I think that's a really good tactic.
Yeah. I think also if we're talking specifically about London, your observation is 100% correct about especially people who grew up on the outskirts of London and who like their entire uni group and their friends from home all moved into London. So I find that those groups, like you said, are very like close-knit, hard to infiltrate. But that's not the case usually with foreigners. Mm. So that's why like Americans, I do have loads of American friends because we're all really good at just like, we all know how it is. And we're always trying to make friends. A lot of our friends are in and out of the city, you know, moving various other places. But also other foreigners are the same. They tend to be more open to meeting new people and just more friendly. And especially if you're from abroad, they're like, we get it. We know how it is. Whereas a lot of the Brits here who have never done that before, they don't get it. So they're just very closed off, which is fine. Like, do your thing. But yeah, I would say like almost all my friends now are not British, actually, or not. They're not English or from like outside of just like the home counties, as they call them. I do have some British friends who are from like Belfast and things like that, which is a big move. So
what about things that we like about British guys are dating? Because I feel like what we've been talking about sounds kind of bleak and people are like, wow, there's no hope out there in London or Britain. And I'm curious if there like a lifestyle they live that you're really like, ooh, I like that, or the way they do something.
She's like, you're right. No, we have been a bit bleak and hard on them. So, and also, you know, that's a generalization. Like, I actually have been on quite a few dates recently with guys where I'm like, oh, actually, there are English/British men out there that are, you know, they'll make the plan. They actually are attractive. They're like, oh, no, I'll take care of this. Like, it's been really nice getting to know you. I have good, like, really good taste in food. So we go on really nice, interesting dates and stuff. So there are really good ones out there. And I have yet to nail one down, but they can be out there. I'm trying to think if there's anything specifically. I mean, personally, I really like I love how a lot of Englishmen dress. So agreed. I specifically really, so I live in East London, but the ironic thing is that I love the West London look, which is more like tailored suits and everything's like tailored and extremely classic looks and polo shirts and like a nice pea coat. I love that. Whereas, you know, American men, generally speaking, I don't feel are quite up to par with fashion. So some of them are. In New York, like I've been on dates with guys who dress really nicely in New York. But yeah, so I do love, like I just love a crisp West London look, basically.
Love it. And what about like the South England versus North England? I heard they call them Southern fairies and Northern monkeys, which is actually for everyone why Arctic monkeys, I think, is the name of what they are, because of that whole, they're from the North. Oh. And so that was a thing. And I was like, oh, why is it called that? And they're like, oh, well, Southern fairies, they tend to think, oh, they're so posh and they wear their hair slicked back and they're a little like feminine. And the Northern ones are like industrial and get out there and hard as nails. And it's funny because I've been to both London and Manchester and I can now spot a British guy a mile away and know where they're from because they either have their hair slicked back or they have this weird little bowl cut that literally looks, I don't even know what it is. It's so ugly. And I'm like, oh, they're from Manchester or Northern England. I could spot these guys a mile away. I went on a boat in Australia and all these guys had the little bowl cut and they have these sunglasses that are super round and they always wear these striped shirts. And I just went up to him and I'm like, are you from Manchester? He's like, yeah, I'm from Manchester. I'm like, I knew it. It's just so easy to spot. So I don't know if you have any things like that you just know where they're from based on their look.
Yeah, I mean, I would say like I'm better versed on the East London versus West London because East London is extremely like hipster, trendy, bucket hats, like all that kind of stuff. And then the more classic and also huge sweeping generalizations here. I can kind of differentiate between the North and the South. But I mean, moving here and learning about all that, considering how small England is, is there's a lot of divides in terms of also the accents too. So that is mind-blowing to me how different, even Liverpool and Manchester are not that far from each other and their accents are so different. And yeah, culturally, like so different. And yeah, I've heard the north-south divide is just crazy. And actually really like, it's very divide. It's like problematically dividing sometimes. But I also kind of get like, they're just extremely different cultures and a lot of working class up north. So obviously like they look down on, you know, people or look down like actually, you know, looking south at people who, you know, work in city or live in Surrey in like a country house. And yeah, I think it's also the class stuff here is, in my opinion, way more prevalent than in the US. So that's a huge part of where that factors in as well. And yeah, it's like, it can be extremely snobby both ways, actually. So it's super interesting to see.
It is, because like you said, it's not that big. And the train to Manchester from London is what, 2 hours? And you're like, oh, okay, I'll just pop off the train and we'll be the same. And it's very much not. You can just tell as soon as you get off the train, there's a shift in energy, a shift in the way people are. And that's why I like going to both, because I'm like, I like getting both of those energies. So it's really interesting. I would love to wrap up with just a British saying or slang or word that you've picked up that you love or like love to use in your daily lingo.
Ooh, okay. So for me, I use a lot of subtle things because when I go back to New York or I have friends here from the US, they're like, oh, that's so British of how you said that. Like I say, like things are sorted and I say like a lot of, oh, that's lovely. Oh, so he was so lovely. She was so lovely. That's apparently quite British of me. I have fully reverted to calling it the toilet, not the bathroom, because if you say bathroom here, people are like, it's not a bathroom. It's a toilet, which is so specific. And I say loo as well. I have no shame in saying loo, even though I'm not British. And then like, I also, what's interesting is that I've been here for 10 years now and a lot of these sayings, people will ask me, oh, is that how you say it in the US? Is it the same or is there a different way? And I'm like, I don't remember, actually. There's some things like obviously no sweater and jumper and pants for underwear versus pants like trousers and stuff like that. But some stuff I actually cannot remember anymore, which if it's the same or if we say it a different way or anything like that. So yeah, I think those are probably, it's a lot of like smaller ones that, and also to be fair, a lot of us say to be fair, or calling something interesting when we is like a nice, it's like a euphemism of, oh, okay, that sounds really interesting. And it's like, that's not really actually.
It's not that interesting.
Yeah.
I'm living with a girl from the North right now and she says doing my head in. And oh, she just means like it's giving me a headache or it's like a nightmare to sort out. And so we were trying to get these tickets for something. She's like, oh, it's doing my head in. And I'm like, I love that phrase. I'm just going to start using it. I love sorted. I say everything. I'm like sorted. Flat now to me is just like, I don't even say apartment. I'm like, oh yeah, we live in a flat and here's our flat. And I forget that when I go home, people are like, oh, you've been abroad. Now you say flat. I'm like, I'm just so used to it. And it's easier to me than saying three syllables of apartment.
Oh yeah.
And what's the other one? Oh my God, I just actually love the train safety. That's see it, say it, sort it. Oh, I think it's so cute and funny. And I just keep talking about it. I don't know why I love it. I'm like, it seems like a good tagline for the safety thing. Like see it, say it, sort it. So yeah. I love it. This has been so much fun. Can you tell everyone, obviously we've been talking about Love in London, but like what do you have coming up? Where can everyone find you?
Yeah. So, well, Love in London is just Love in London across everything. Our website as well, YouTube channel. Also, I've got my own account, Jess Dante, which I haven't really figured out exactly what I'm doing on there, but mix of talking about the behind the scenes of the business, a little bit about dating sometimes, about living in London, being a citizen here. Sometimes it's just pictures of me in blue trousers. And yeah, but I also like to share like more personal stuff on there. It's a bit more fun for me. And what is coming up? So nothing like majorly exciting, I would say, at the moment. We're doing a lot of refinements to the business. So trying to like work on the Shopify shop and not do any major launches anytime soon because we just kind of want to get some more systems in place, which is not a very fun answer.
Oh, no. I tell everyone when I go through that stuff, it's like my NBA rebuild phase where it's like the team isn't going to win the championship this year, but next year we're coming back stronger. We all need those where we're like, I just need to rebuild a second. We're going to get some things that aren't going to be exciting and fun, and it's really boring to work on the back end, but it all pays off in the end.
Oh, yeah. It is. It's, I mean, actually, I find it kind of exciting. I think it's fun to like try different things. But yeah, for the podcast, maybe not as, it's not like, well, cool, you're working with blah, 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 or anything like that. But yeah, but it's, that's part of, that's a huge part of business, isn't it? So, but yeah.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Jess. I love this conversation. If you guys want to hear part two, let us know. Maybe we'll get even deeper into dating and stuff.
Oh, I love that. I'm happy to come back on.
So. I love it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you again to Jess for sharing all the insider tips on dating and acclimating to London. I know as an American, moving to a new country can be really hard. And that's why you need to follow accounts like Jess's Love in London, which will help you adjust so much easier. I just learned a tip that I had no idea about. When you are going into the tube, you need to use the same payment method or else the tube actually thinks you're still on it and will essentially think you're going all around the city all day because you didn't use the same payment method to tap out. So when you're tapping in, if you use your phone and then you tap out and you use an actual physical card, it thinks it's two different payment methods. I was like, what? I have literally been to London so many times and never knew that. And I have looked at my account and been like, this seems like it's not right based on the actual trip that I went on. And that was just one tip from one video that she had. So if you want to learn more stuff like that, again, go follow her, Love in London. I love the tone of everything. It's so, so helpful. And you know where to find me. At Chelsea Reif on Instagram, chelseareif.com. And if you want to launch a podcast, you know where to go, Mic Drop. It's the ultimate podcast launch course and will take you through everything you need to know about podcasting. So if you think, oh, well, I'm not a tech wizard, I don't know how to figure out tech, I built videos for that. If you're like, well, I'm pretty confident in tech, but I don't know how to creatively plan, like I don't know how to outline episodes or what to talk about, I've got you there too. And if you're like, I just don't know how to create cover art or pick a name or actually record, like how does all that work? That's inside Mic Drop as well. So head to Mic Drop on my website. Email me if you have any questions, info@chelseareif.com. And just a reminder, anyone who leaves a review during the month of September, you'll be entered into a giveaway to win a one-on-one 20-minute session with me. So go to Apple Podcasts, scroll down to the section on my podcast where it says write a review. So literally just go to my feed and then just keep scrolling until you see that. Write your review, screenshot it, and then send it to info@chelseareif.com. I will pull a winner at the end of the month to win this 20-minute coaching session with me. And last but not least, you can call in to the In My Non-Expert Opinion hotline. I think we should come up with a really fun name for this. Like, I don't know what it is yet, but I would love to hear your thoughts. Maybe DM me them on Instagram. Like, what should this hotline be called? But you can leave a voice note. So just go to the show notes and click the link. You'll record this on your laptop and ask me whatever you want, whether that's about podcasting, travel, dating, budgeting for travel, making friends, anything you've heard me talk about on the podcast and you want me to share more about, leave a question on the hotline and I'll answer on air. As always, thank you so much for listening and I'll see you in the next episode.